Oh, that's a lovely goal. Well done.
That was some goal.
They've invaded the pitch. Look at the way he takes it on the run. Watch. He just sort of a half volley. Is it over?
No, another 30 seconds or so. It's over now.
Yeah, it's over now.
He played full time, I don't know.
This is the first All Ireland for years I haven't been there now on duty.
Yeah.
Could you imagine the push now?
I was just thinking underneath the tunnel, the tunnel, and you'd be all linking arms.
You're linking arms trying to keep the crowd back, yeah, it's great. There's a great sense of excitement just at that stage, isn't there?
There's a super. Callahan.
And Michael Donovan.
But all we can see directing operations. Keep back to swap up. Bring in the Casper. Oh, Louis Nugent.
Fantasy. The hill looks well, doesn't
it? Yeah.
I hadn't seen it since it was done.
A bunch of Irish Gardaí sit in a house in the dusty town of Ushakati in Ovamboland, northern Namibia. They watch a month-old video of the All-Ireland hurling final. They know the score, but have not previously seen the game. They try to feel the excitement of Nicky English's wonderful last-minute goal. Yet, somehow, they seem to feel more emotion watching their colleagues control the crowd as the Tipperary players head towards the Hogan Stand to collect the McCarthy Cup and their medals. One part of their minds longs for the familiar, another part relishes the unknown that presents itself daily to them on this, the Garda Síochána's first overseas mission with the United Nations.
That's a TK-57, I think it's called. It's a Russian landmine. It would be used by the SWAPO guerrillas against the Southwest African police and also the South African army. Now, as you can see, we're about less than a mile from Ushakati. And this is the first little minor road that you leave as you leave Ushakati. It's about 200 yards off the road. It was planted here sometime during the war here in April. We were driving along the road here one day, and just
well, that's this April. This was
that's
the,
this
the,
April.
This was the incursion.
This was the incursion right. By SWAPO in April after April the 1st. We were driving along the road one day, and two or three of the local people jumped out and told us to not go any further. So when we inquired a little bit more, they explained that there had been landmines planted here during the night. So we came up by foot, they showed us where the landmine was, and we contacted the South African army. And they came out and they took out the charger.
As I walked through the war zone one evening in May, a terrible sound filled me up with dismay. I heard a house of burn, he was crying in pain. Oh, take me away, boys, the boats never came. Here we are in our gas masks and combats. No more of Windhoek will be seen. Sure as all the UN, just who are they fooling? With the gunfire at night, we can't get any.
About 500 miles north of Windhoek, we're about less than 20 miles from the Angolan border. Ushakati, the base we live in, is strictly a military base. There's nothing else in Ushakati. There's no town, there's no, shall we say, main street, there's no industries. Outside of the base, the Ovambos live in their traditional corrals, etc. The military base that we live in has only been planted here the last 20 years. If there was no war going on, this wouldn't be here at all. It would just be open countryside. So the facilities, as you can imagine, are not what you would find in a normal city or a normal town. We don't, for instance, all the lads here, we have to go about 300 miles to get our haircut down to a place called Tumeb. We buy our cornflakes in bulk down in Windhoek when we go down, any of the lads go down. Those type of things are not supplied up here. So it's quite isolated where we are at the moment.
Old Ushakati's a place we know well, where monitors go if they don't go to hell, where the weather is hot and mosquitoes do play, and the cookfoot are scuttered in the gas.
Caspiers are the huge armoured personnel carriers which have intimidated the people in South Africa's townships and in the war zone of northern Namibia for years. The Kofut are a frightening counterinsurgency unit which specialised in gathering information and killing anyone they thought might be in SWAPO, the Southwest Africa People's Organisation, which won the November elections, which were held under free and fair conditions, largely due to the work of the Gardaí and the other members of the United Nations Transition Assistance Group, which came to bring Africa's last colony to independence. And the super who in the song was crying in pain for the want of post in isolated Oshakati is Superintendent Peter Fitzgerald, who commands the UN police in the Northern District, a group of over 500 policemen monitoring the impartiality of SWAPOL, the local South African-controlled police, in an area almost twice the size of Ireland.
Basically, our function here is to monitor the Southwest African police force. And within that, we have to also do as much as we can to ensure that the election, when it comes up, is free and that the election is fair. Our function, therefore, is to ensure that all cases of intimidation that are reported either to us or to the Southwest African Police are investigated by them properly. And we go with them when they're carrying out their investigations to ensure that these investigations are carried out as they should be.
Peter Fitzgerald is number two in the Irish police contingent of 50, which is part of the 1,500-strong group from 23 countries monitoring the Southwest Africa police. The senior Irish officer is Chief Superintendent Noel Anderson, who's in charge of the Windhoek district, which stretches from the capital to the coast. The first of the UN monitors arrived in Windhoek last April.
First of all, as you know, we were the first monitors in actual fact that left for the mission area, and when we arrived initially was to get sort of a working accommodation, get ourselves established, and we went, we worked out a Sinehof base initially, and including the Commissioner, Mr. Fanning, and at that stage we just had three rooms, and from there we sort of built our organisation. Accommodation for our own people while we got fixed up in the state hospital. It wasn't ideal, but it was quite good. It was reasonably comfortable, and we had access to the state canteen, the state hospital canteen, for meals. After 3 or 4 days, then my colleagues then split up and moved off up to Oshakati. So that's where the team, in actual fact, divided at that particular stage.
When we arrived, things were very, very bleak in the north. First of all, in relation to things like office facilities and accommodation, they just didn't exist. We started off in a room in a house. On our arrival, we found that the Kofut, who are a counter-insurgency unit attached to the local Southwest African police force, were patrolling the streets and patrolling the area in Caspers, which are large armour-protected vehicles. The people in the area were terrified by these vehicles, and they were a great source of intimidation. We found that when we came here, the people that were supporting, in particular the SWAPO party, were afraid to wear the SWAPO colours, they were afraid to carry the flags, they were afraid to hold political rallies. And any of them that did were assaulted, they were intimidated, they were threatened, they were even arrested and beaten. I think it's very encouraging at this stage to look out on the street, as one can any day of the week, and see these same supporters now going by in their colours, wearing their shirts, singing their songs, holding their rallies, and with no fear of being intimidated for doing these things.
The first major event, I suppose, when we came up here around the 20th of April, was, I think, the 28th of April, we escorted 27, 28 planned fighters to the Angolan border. And
that's the SWAPO army.
Yeah, that's the guerrilla end of the SWAPO army. And we brought them with Malbat to the border, and they were handed across the border at Ruakana. So that was a big event at that time. A lot of media coverage, etc.
What was your feeling about that whole operation?
Well, we were very much involved in it. Myself, Peter Kenny, and Pat Leahy, we had four plan persons in the vehicle with us, and we found it very interesting to converse with them. Most of them could speak quite good English, and quite a few of them had spent time abroad. One of the guys actually studied music in Cuba, which was an unusual pastime for a guerrilla fighter, you know.
Garda Pat Barron's first encounter with PLAN fighters, members of the SWAPO guerrilla army, after they had arrived armed where they should not have been, south of the Angolan border last April. Over 400 of them were killed by South African forces. It was not the welcome home they'd hoped for. It was also hardly what the Gardaí had expected. Nor did they expect to have to stand up in the pulpits of churches of many denominations to explain their role in the country. In the township of Katatura, where blacks had to live outside Windhoek, Garda Pat Conway was one of the first to have to break the ice for the UN monitors.
When we came here first, we were actually out here. We were 3 weeks out here. It was our first station. And it's totally different. There's no comparison with the problems that are out here and what we face in town. Here, there's total social deprivation. There's people living 16, 17 to a house, large families, the problem with alcoholism and unemployment, all the social problems that you can associate with such 50 or 60,000 people all living together in such a small area.
Just coming through. I think the doors say what tribe is supposed to be living in a particular house, and we've come through an area with some DTA flags, and that was a Herero area, but I see all the Swabo flags up here, so this must be the Ovambo area.
This actually is the market. This area here is the market. This is the you can get everything here, from meat, a haircut, your shoes, your laundry done, everything. You get everything here. Buy a car, do whatever you want. It's all here, all spread out in front of you.
What about contact with the people when you were out here? What sort of preoccupations did they have? What were they saying to you? How much do you think you were able to get to know them?
Well, we were out here originally. We went to all the schools. We used to trip around to all the schools in the daytimes and the youth clubs and the cubs, and we talked to them, explain our function, what we were here for, and you know, explain where we come from and where our station was and what our function was. And they used to come down and get posters and stickers off us, and we'd bring them into the school so they could put them up and explain exactly the function of UNTAG in general and us as police monitors, what we were here for, so they could tell their parents, because a lot of the parents cannot speak English, but the children can. They're learning English at school. When we left here, the Jamaicans took over, and because they were black, they were even more interesting to the people. They were delighted to see black policemen, friendly black policemen.
The only crime Pat Conway and his partner Ted Murphy had to report that Saturday afternoon, as they accompanied a Swapo patrol in Windhoek, was the theft of a child's bicycle. The opulent white suburbs of the capital were quiet as the residents watched a rugby match. In the north, the terrain is rougher, as I discovered bouncing over it, standing up in a caspier, always looking ahead, ready to duck to avoid low branches on the scrawny trees. The UN caspier was accompanying two Swapo caspiers from the station at Ohanguina. Garda Tom Scully shared the driving with a policeman from Guyana in South America. Tom and three other guards had arrived a month previously at Ohanguina from the even less hospitable Inhana.
It's worse. Inhana was a terrible place. Ohanguina is a paradise compared to it.
Well, describe the two of them to me, will you?
Well, I'll start with Ohanguina. Four of us share a prefab porta cabin type building. There's two bedrooms and a toilet and a shower. This is a palace compared to Inhana, where we lived in a caravan. There was one toilet between 40 guys, and the water didn't work most of the time. We're very happy in Ohanguina.
In Oshakati, Peter Fitzgerald feels the days of privation are over.
When we came up originally, there were 25 of us in two houses. We now have the luxury of having only seven of us in a house. Most of us, as young constables, would have lived in police stations. I myself started as a guard in Pier Street in Dublin, and I lived for several years in a room with six other guards in Pier Street. And most of the men that are with me now would have at some stage lived in Garda stations and would have experienced living with other men. I suppose if one were to look at our surroundings today, we have reasonable conditions. Initially we had no hot water, we had no cooking facilities, we had no showers even. Now at least we have hot water and we have one shower between six of us. We're not doing too bad really.
And then there's Ruakana, up on the Angolan border, where Sergeant Leo McGinn and five Gardaí are stationed.
The problems with Ruakana would be its remoteness. The location, you're 170 kilometres north of Oshakati. But then again, when you're in Oshakati, where are you? I'd also class it rather remote. Coming up here, the first thing we learned was that it was easier to get whiskey than it is to get tomatoes or fresh vegetables. And we found that to be true. Well, we're not that we're looking for the whiskey, but we're certainly looking for the fresh vegetables. Inaccessibility is the problem with this location. Certainly you have a tarred road, but you're 2 hours away from the nearest, the next white man, I suppose.
But of course, having come out in the second phase, there were people here before. Did you know enough about what you were going to come into, or did you think it was going to be a little city, town? Jim?
Before we came out, we did a week-long course in headquarters, and they briefed us well, they prepared us well, and they issued us with equipment that has proved very useful, and the type of clothing we were issued with proved very useful, and the medical treatment and the way we were prepared before we came out by the Garda surgeon was more than adequate, and we find that we're one of the better prepared police forces that are here in Namibia.
But was there anything that you weren't expecting, even though, you know, as I say, there was a bunch of guards out before you, were there still things that took you by surprise? In other words, is it possible to learn it at Garda headquarters, or do you have to be on the ground before you actually know? How do you imagine Namibia when you're not here? Seamus?
I don't think you will actually ever experience Namibia until you actually arrive and see it for yourself. You can learn these things from books, theoretically, but in practical, it's always the best to come here and experience it, because things are totally different, very different.
Well, can you say what's different? Can you say now really what has surprised you since you came?
You hear about people living in corrals and their conditions and how they live and their culture. For example, the Hemba, they're the fifth most primitive tribe in the world. And you can visualize these things in your own mind, but when you come and see them and see exactly how they live and their conditions, it's just a massive culture shock to you.
And how would you describe them?
From my first impression was that I just stood back and looked at them and said, God, these people are unbelievable as to how they live. I categorized them as Stone Age people living in a Stone Age world who haven't experienced westernized customs or ordinary, everyday living things like commodities, for example.
What other things have surprised you? Bill, anything else that's particularly struck you as strange?
No, I suppose that just the temperatures, I suppose, are extreme, but I think we've all adjusted quite well to it. No, just the people's way of life, the locals, they're very primitive in the way they do live.
No hurling.
Yes.
No hurling.
No hurling.
Most of the different tribes around are very primitive compared to what we thought they were like, you know. Mm. But by no means backward in the way they are. They are quite intelligent and clever in their own way.
And what about social life? What do you do? How do you, you know, when you come off duty, do you come back to this house, which is a very fine house, but obviously sparsely furnished? You're not going to stay here for the whole of your life. So it lacks the home comforts, doesn't it?
Well, we've done the most we can to make the house a home. We all get on very well together. We eat mainly the Irish dishes. There's some fine, or some excellent cooks here. But again, when you mention social life, what we were used to back at home doesn't exist out here. There are no pubs, there are no discos.
Correction.
What's wrong, Seamus?
There are too many pubs here.
Too many pubs.
The equivalent to a cocker shop.
Yeah, but they are not places we frequent.
True.
Social life has taken a major turn, and it's something I look forward to getting back to the owl scene at home. And Sally O'Brien, certainly.
Leo McGinn at Ruacana with his colleagues Jim Mitchell, Seamus Tracy and Bill McDonald, claiming the local pubs aren't for them. Tom Scully and the lads at Ohanguina are also thrown back on their own resources for social life.
Well, it's pretty bad. You have to make your own thing. We're working most of the time. We finish up around 6 in the evening when we get something to eat. Generally, we have a type of a barbecue, and one of the guys got a guitar, and we light a fire and sing Irish songs around it till midnight, and then go to bed. And that's about it.
And what about the other people, the police from other countries? Is there much interrelation between you?
Well, there is. We get on very well with all the nationalities here. We have Norwegians, Nigerians, Pakistanis, Moroccans, Guyanans. In South America, that is. We have guys from Ghana in South Africa. There's a Russian. He's in the... He's not Civpol now. He's in the other side of things. That's about it. There's a lot of nationalities here, and we all get on very well.
So have they learnt any Irish songs, have they?
Oh, they have. We have them singing Nora and Red is the Rose and Spancil Hill.
None of which songs were sung by the Gardaí when they had their first get-together of the whole Irish contingent at Tsumeb, halfway between Windhoek and Oshakati, in October, 6 months into their year-long mission. But aided by the guitars of Tom London, Barry Worrell and Larry Cody, not to mention the occasional glass for the non-pioneers, they did manage some other Irish ballads.
I've been a wild rover for many days.
Since last they met, they had been through a lot. First, they had to establish some sort of relationship with the police whose performance they'd come to monitor. Tom London, Peter Kenny and Noel Anderson spoke about that. Then came the task of registering the 700,000 voters who chose the Constituent Assembly which will write the constitution for Namibia's independence. Tom London spent time in the bush as those who live far from the towns signed their names or placed their thumbprints.
When we first arrived at the Swapo, they were very much under the impression, I think, that if they ignored us and that they kind of insulted us enough that we'd all go away. But slowly but surely they began to relay us over the last 6 months that we're here to stay, we're here till next April and we're going to see this process through. They've come around quite well. I am now, since finishing the registration, I'm on what's known as an investigation team. And my job is to go out with a local detective from the local police force to investigate assault cases or intimidation cases, particularly of a political nature. Say a Swapo person comes in and says that he was beaten or his house was burnt down by DTA supporters, which would be the opposition party to Swapo. It is up to me to make sure that the detective does that investigation properly. There has been allegations in the past that if a Swapo person made an allegation or if a Swapo person was beaten up, that the local police force took no action. So now my job is to make sure that everyone is treated fairly here.
Possibly the first time I went to a murder scene would probably be the biggest incident that happened to me, and the way it was investigated and the total interest in life here, and life is so cheap. And in comparison to home, when an investigation could last weeks, the whole investigation was over here in about 10 minutes. A murder at home is investigated right from the scene and preservation of the scene and statements from witnesses and photography, forensic. It would be a major investigation. Whereas here, they don't seem to put in the effort. Possibly the fact that there's more murders here and more incidents of a serious nature here than at home. But they don't seem to have, first of all, I would say, the experience. Second of all, the facilities for investigating these type of incidents.
Initially, I suppose it'd be fair to say there was a certain coolness there. No police force likes another police force looking over their shoulder. But this was part of the overall mandate, the UN mandate. Initially, when we came here, there was a rally or a meeting within a very short time of arrival. And I was quite surprised, actually. First of all, the strength of the Swapo turned out, and they were extremely heavily armed. Whereas recently, now we had the major rally with the president of Swapo, Mr. Samuel Nyuma. The Swapo turned out, but not as heavily armed, and the Morris kept a very low profile, kept in the background, so to speak. Whereas in actual fact, the untagged Civ Politers, monitors went on a very high profile on that particular rally. So they have changed, and most interestingly also, they have met the Swapo people here in relation to that particular rally, with two very good meetings and two very constructive meetings. And the situation has improved very, very much, particularly in the last couple of weeks. And I'm glad to say they have improved. We're getting on professionally well with them. Don't always see eye to eye on things. That's the way. But if we're not happy about something, we will put our cards on the table and we'll tell them why.
Tom, during the registration period, which went on for a number of weeks, you were going out into rural areas and you were living for, I think, about a week at a time in the bush.
Yeah, that's correct.
Not something you're used to.
No. It's not like Kilsheelan and Tipperary anyway. I was on what was known as a bush team. Our job was to go out and register the people to vote. There had been an election in Namibia about 10 years ago, but Swapo at the time had told the people not to vote. So the vast majority of people in Ovambuland had never registered before.
Now, our job was, there was a team put together of South African, Namibian people. They would be civil servants who came in to register. And there was a UN civilian. He would be monitoring the South African people to make sure that they were registering the votes properly. My job was to monitor the policeman who was with the team. We spent 5 weeks living out in the bush. We were about 200 miles south of Ashikati. We were just along the border of Etoshepan, which is a huge game reserve here in Namibia. It's about half the size of Ireland. And we worked, it was very, very isolated area, very much so.
What were conditions like? How did you live? What did you live on? Where did you sleep?
We slept out in the open. We slept in sleeping bags. We lit a campfire. We would stay in each place about 2 or 3 days. We would find a clearing in the bush. We'd light a fire, set up a camp for the night, sleep around on the ground. There was about 9 Ovambus who would be in the civil service here, what they call the Ovambu administration. They were part of the registration team, and they were a great help to me in particular in teaching me how to live in the bush. We'd go out each evening to usually the local headman who we'd been with all day, and he would sell us a goat for about £20. The Ovambus would then bring it back to the camp. They would kill it, they would skin it, and they would cut the meat up for the night, and then we would cook it over an open fire. So I had delicacies like goat's brains and sheep's eyes. These types of, as I say, it's not Kilsheelan in Tipperary.
How'd you take to those?
It's like a lot of those type of delicacies. If you didn't know what it was, it's quite nice. It's the hardest part is knowing what you're eating. But it's like this, when you're hungry, you eat anything.
Well, any strange adventures?
Yes, one particular night we were asleep in the camps. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. We were right north of the wild game reserve. You could hear elephants, you could hear lions, hyenas, particularly now hyenas. And one night, the head of Ovambo who was with me, I got on quite well with him, Titus was his name, and Titus said to me, he says, I can smell a hyena. And hyena eats rotten meat, the carcasses of dead animals, and there's an extremely bad smell of dead meat off the animal. And I couldn't smell it now, but he could smell it all right. But during that night, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke to what really was the most terrible smell I have ever got. And I jumped up, and the hyenas were eating the meat off the tree that we cut during the night. And the Ovambus were off shooting their weapons at them. They all carry rifles with them in the bush. And they were all up running after them into the bush trying to shoot them.
Was there any danger there from the hyenas?
Yes, the Ovambus and the South Africans were telling me that. The South Africans are great people to go out and hunt and stay in the bush for a week on an end. They have what's called a braai, what we call it, a barbecue at home. And they a few beers, and they eat a lot of meat. They're great meat eaters in this country. And they'd fall asleep at night time. And with the drink, they'd be sleeping fairly heavy. During the dry season, game becomes a bit scarce. And what happens is the hyena can smell the meat from the camp. And it will come into the camp, and it can actually smell the meat from the man's mouth. And there has been cases of where the hyenas actually attack people. A hyena has the most powerful jaws in the world. It's more powerful than any other animal, and there's been many cases where they've killed a man in his sleep, you know. So they are quite dangerous. This time of the year, not too bad, because you have the rain season, a lot of game around.
It's a first-time UN mission for the Gardaí, and it has not been without its difficulties. They came unsure of what to expect from other police forces. Would the others be better prepared, better trained? Would their police methods stand the test better? The answer has been no. Former Assistant Commissioner Stephen Fanning is the head of the UN police. The two leaders of the Irish contingent, Noel Anderson and Peter Fitzgerald, command the two most prestigious and challenging districts. They and the men under them have performed with credit through the difficult settling-in period, through registration of voters, through the election campaign when the North in particular lived on the edge of inter-party violence, through the election which went off well, and so far through its aftermath when again the North has seen limited violence. They did it by teamwork and commitment, above all through sticking closely together. Though in isolated places like Ruakana, they shared their togetherness with the New Zealanders, the Fijians, the Germans and others. Martin Bushell and Jim Mitchell explained.
Every country has sent out their own contingent, and they're all familiar with their own people. It's like the devil you know and the devil you don't know. So as we're all Irish, we're all familiar with each other, our own ways. The six of us here have got quite close together living in the one house. So you know who you can depend on, who you can't depend on. Some of the other nationalities we have found maybe not as well trained as us, we can't depend on them as much. So from that point of view, we stick together fairly closely. But as regards the work side of it, When we were out on patrol, we were all mixed. We get on well with the other guys. They call to the house here, as we said before. But I think there is a closeness there, but it's not an agreement we've come to. It's just a thing that has happened from coming out here in a group.
What about the people, the other people, the other police forces mixing with them, getting involved with them? Today, while we've been in the house, there have been Germans, New Zealanders in here with Fijians just come across the road waving in. But that's at a very superficial level. Does it go any deeper than that?
Well, the Irish house, it appears to be like a visiting house. That the door is here, it's open, and they're in and out of it, and they're more often in this house than they are in their own house. The Europeans, we have a lot in common with, food-wise and lifestyles. Some of the African countries, we're slightly different, but you know, we're learning a lot from them, and they're also picking up a little from us. But by and large here, things are fine.
And when it comes to the pub sing-song, a passing Dane might be able to turn the tables on the Irish who prepare to recoil from a Nordic ditty.
Jeg har været i slammet, men nu er det slut med at bruge hver øre på damer og skrut. Og nu vender jeg hjemme, men helt uden mynd. Det liv er til ende, et andet begynd. Så det er slut med at suge. Med at suge, min ven. Nu tager jeg aldrig mere til Fyborg igen.
But I can play another song.
Apart from the occasional attempt at sabotage by Danes and Swedes, the night at Zumeb, which brought all the Gardaí together for the first time, was a wholly Irish and sometimes sentimental affair.
Ride the finest horse I have ever seen, standing 16, one or two, with eyes wild and green. You ride the horse so well, hands light to the touch. I could never go with you, no matter how I wanted to. Ride on, see you. I could never.
As Larry Cody's voice and guitar lead us into a Christy Moore session, it's perhaps time to ask what our policemen in Namibia miss most during their long duty overseas. First, Peter Kenny and Pat Barron.
Well, there are a lot of things that the normal run-of-the-mill things that you miss from home, like the food here obviously is different, the weather climate is much different. Like the things that I missed most, to be honest, is going to the All-Ireland final, going to Croke Park, going to the football final, meeting the lads after it, having a few pints, and those things I miss. Like, we've got all the videos, but you know the result 9 times out of 10, and the atmosphere isn't the same. And like, still we've sat down and watched matches and probably treated them like as if we were there and made our own bit of atmosphere, but still deep down you feel it's 5-6 weeks after the event, and it probably doesn't create the same impression on you as it would have if you were there.
Social life, because our social life evolves mostly around ourselves here, whereas at home you have your friends to socialise with, etc. I miss the seasons as well. You look out the window here in the morning and you don't ask yourself, is it going to rain? The sun shines every day. And now as we're approaching high summer here, each day is becoming warmer and warmer. And no doubt sleep here is going to become a problem for a few weeks until we really acclimatise to it. The green grass of Ireland, of course, everything here is dull, yellow. Just generally Ireland and life in Ireland.
I hear my Casper coming, it's rolling round the bend. I haven't seen windows since I don't know when. I volunteered in Dublin, seems like years ago. And I'm stuck in Oshagabi, and I want to go.
A saying we have here in the morning, when we get up, we look out and say, well, any rain today?
Exactly.
You know, every day temperatures rise to about 40, 43, and some rain would be nice occasionally.
Well, that'll come in about a month's time. Anything else missed?
The seasons, I suppose. Yeah, no. we all think about October, and we kind of dream what October is like at home. Mm-hmm. But here it's just the same the whole time, heat all the time. That's what we miss, I suppose.
But there must be a commodity. There must be some commodity that you can't get 170 kilometres from a shop, and even when you get the 170 kilometres, it's not there. What is it you most miss?
Well, I think in general at home, most of us probably when we're going to work or come for work, we usually drop in and get a newspaper. Mm. It's one thing you can't get here, no way, unless you get some of the local papers, which they're not very close to us here either. It's 110 miles to Ashikati, I think, for the nearest one. So other than that...
The fresh pint of milk. We have to go to make a cup of tea. We have to go to Ashikata to get the drop of milk to put into it. So it's grand. But that's one thing that you'd miss, and good quality tea, you know.
Haven't seen the TV, haven't seen the phone, haven't seen the postman. I guess we're all alone, but we're all in Ashikata, and no one gives a damn.
I suppose professionally the greatest difficulty was starting from scratch in early April without even a typewriter, without even envelopes or paper. We started in a room in a private house with my own 17 monitors from Ireland. I now find myself in charge of a district with 560 monitors from 23 different countries. We had to set up that district. I had to set up each of my 12 stations. We had to equip those stations. I even had to go out and negotiate with the local headmen for the ground on which these stations were built. So that has been a tremendous challenge, and it has been a very enjoyable challenge. And I think at this stage that we have a reasonably efficient district. We hope to improve on that as time goes on, and indeed daily we do improve on it, but I think as things stand we have a reasonably efficient district. On a personal level, I think the biggest problem is being away from my wife and children.
I picked it from the border, this Casper, it was mine. I guess I'd keep it rolling further down the line. Cars of the Washington, that's where I long to be. But the Yonta keeps on calling, so it's so bamboo land for me.
At Ruakana, that was Seamus Tracy, Bill McDonald, Jim Mitchell and Leo McGinn. And in Ashikati, Superintendent Peter Fitzgerald. Of course, all of them said what they missed most was the family. However, together they feel they all miss home and those they love. In Ashikati, they live in three houses, only one of which has a TV and video. We had to break in to watch that hurling final because the residents of the TV house were either home on leave or out on duty. And so some of the lonely hours are spent writing and singing songs like the Casper song you've just heard, sung by Pat Barron, Dermot O'Shea, Alan Murray, John Kelly, Barry Worrell, Tom London, Jim Heshen, Peter Kenny and Ollie Goggin.
If any of this gets home, as I say, you won't even be able to drink a Calibre.
Yeah.
Anywhere
in Dublin.
Anywhere in Dublin. Drink so much as a Riffig Orange, you're in trouble.
They can sing songs and crack jokes, but the work is often demanding in a physical sense, particularly when on Casper patrol. Tom London showed me over to Casper. He and Tom Scully took me out on patrol in one, accompanying two local police Caspers.
It sits about 10 people. When they went out on patrol, they usually went out with four of these, and they went with a machine called the Blesbok. That's the machine that would carry all their equipment. And you would have eight local Ovambos, and you would have two South Africans. And there would be a 40-man team, as I say, four Caspers. And of the eight whites that would be there, there was one white who would be in charge of the company. They call it Zulu Company, Alpha Company or whatever. They're a fantastic machine. They're built for the bush, specifically for the bush. They are anti-mine. They weigh about 12 ton. And I've seen cases where these have actually hit a landmine. And all they have done is just had to change the wheel. That's all. They are totally protective. They're very, very good. The South Africans swear by them.
I've got double glazed.
Yeah, all the windows along the side, they're only narrow windows. They're all bulletproof, and they've been tested time and time again. We've seen lots of cases where they have been hit by bullets and they're just a crack in them, but they are bulletproof.
It's the little slats here for shooting at us.
Yeah, beside each chair, each sheet inside this machine, there's a little porthole which they put their rifles out of. They usually have either FN rifles or they would have these R5s. They would also carry sometimes weapons they'd seize from SWAPO. Most of these patrols would have a rocket launcher with them, which they are not supplied by the South Africans at all. It's specifically that what they've taken from SWAPO. They would have Kalashnikovs also at times. They're very, very heavily armed. They're very strong on firepower.
Oh, they're really throwing up the sand over there, aren't
yeah.
they?
Yeah. You get out of that now because that's a turbo. They're very good. Used to get stuck a lot in the Shaunas during the wet season. That's around January, February. And we've often seen photos of four or five of them stuck together. And what they have to do is get a big long rope and pull one out at a time. They get furious when they get stuck. He's fairly stuck now, all right.
He's digging himself further
he
in.
He is, yeah. That's what these tow bars here, see these? That's what they're for.
Oh, yeah.
He's out now.
Okay. He's made it.
That's what.
And there they go through the trees.
Yeah, that's what's called bongo bashing.
Bongo bashing.
Yeah, yeah.
But what, is this a regular occurrence now to patrol along the border, a slow patrol in Caspers along the border?
Yes. What's happening here is they're looking for spores. As you can see, there's a
spores or tracks.
Spores or tracks. Yes. There's a gap of about 50 metres between the two borders, which is mostly sand, and of course anyone crossing that, they'll see the spores. And what happens is farmers will cross back and forward, people coming to buy and sell things. It's like our own border at home. Just because it's there doesn't mean people don't come back and forth, just normal social communication. Well, here what happens, they'll see a spore or a track, as they call it, and they'll get down and they'll investigate, and usually the Ovambos will tell you that is a spore of a plant fighter, a Cuban, an Angolan soldier, and I would just say that is just an ordinary farmer going on about his own ordinary business.
Are they pretty good at knowing what size of shoes people wear?
They're excellent. They're absolute. They will describe the person to you by just looking at the footprint, or the spore as they call it. They'll describe whether it's a man, a woman, how old they are. It's really unbelievable. Even the white South Africans who work here with them, they'll say that they have spent, some of these white South Africans have been up here for 10 up to 20 years, some of them, and they'll say that they have never picked up the skill of it at all, but they said they marvel at how the Ovambos are able to do it.
Namibia is due to become independent by next April. If all goes well, the 50 Gardaí can then come home, and the Caspier, the symbol of South African oppression of Namibians, should be thrown on the scrap heap. Tom Scully will miss driving the white UN vehicle. The Gardaí come from a tradition of keeping clear of the press. Their standard answer, they would tell you, used to be, "No comment," and don't quote me on that. But that's changing, and if one lives with them for a few weeks, perhaps they begin to open up a little. They were all most hospitable to me, and when my absent microphone missed the line the first time he uttered it, a little encouragement persuaded Tom Scully to overcome police reluctance to comment and repeat the phrase about the rough border terrain, which has given a title to this programme.
Well, it's pretty warm in there. It's the driving compartment is pretty small, and the heat comes up from below at the joint where the gear lever meets the floor, and it keeps you nice and warm. It's a rugged machine, and it's tough enough to handle.
And the sands are hoor.
And the sands are hoor.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.